Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Hope you guys are all doing well. Today's story is a mystery. I love a mystery. I don't know about you guys. I love a mysterious tale about something mysterious, something that sounds absolutely unbelievable, something that sounds like it was written for a TV show, a movie, or a book, but it's actually real life. This actually happened in the 70s. A mysterious man known as D.B. Cooper hijacked a plane, extorted a hefty ransom from the U.S. government, and then once the goods were secured, jumped from a plane, disappearing without a trace back in the 70s. Real life event. So today on Found Objects, we're going to tell the entire story front to back because I feel like a lot of us think we know the story, but maybe we don't actually know the story, all of the cold hard facts of the story. So today I'm going to tell you guys a little mystery tale from the 70s, if that's okay with you. And I think without further ado, we just get on into it. I don't want to ramble anymore because this story speaks for itself. So let's go back to the 70s. On the crisp afternoon of November 24th, 1971, a man in his mid-40s, dressed in a black suit, white shirt, and narrow black tie, strode through the Portland International Airport. He wore dark sunglasses and carried a black briefcase. His name, according to the one-way ticket that he had purchased for $18.52, was Dan Cooper. Mr. Cooper boarded the Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305, a short 30-minute journey to Seattle, Washington. He took a seat in the rear of the Boeing 727 aircraft and ordered a bourbon and soda. And as the plane lifted off the runway, Cooper's demeanor was calm, almost nonchalant. He lit a cigarette because it was the 70s and you could do that on planes, which is crazy now that we know, I mean, in modern air travel, how many notices there are for no smoking, like no e-cigarettes, nothing. Don't even go in the bathroom and disable that smoke detector because you will be fined. I actually once had a flight. I was going to Cabo with some girlfriends and someone Juuled or something, used an e-cig in the bathroom when we were on the runway. So we'd stopped. We hadn't taken off yet. Like, we were waiting to take off. And I guess it was kind of like a delayed start, like there was something wrong. And so we had to sit for like an hour on the runway, which is not ideal. But someone went to the bathroom and used their e-cigarette and got kicked off the plane before we had been on the runway for an hour and still they got kicked off the plane. So word to the wise, don't do that. So anyway, this man, Mr. Cooper, with his bourbon and soda, lit up his cigarette, exhaled a plume of smoke, and watch the clouds drift by. Midway through the flight, Mr. Cooper handed a note to flight attendant Florence Schaffner. So when she received this note, she saw this passenger giving her a note. She was like, oh, this guy is into me. He's giving me his number. Like, you know, I'm just going to put it in my pocket and look at it later. So she doesn't even read the note that Mr. Cooper handed her. She just puts it in her pocket. Cooper leaned closer, though, his voice steady. Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb. Florence Schaffner, the flight attendant's face paled as she unfolded the paper that she had stuffed in her pocket, which read, quote, I have a bomb in my briefcase. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked. Mr. Cooper opened his briefcase briefly to reveal a tangle of wires and red cylinders. Miss Schaffner, trembling, followed his instructions. She was like, I'm not going to take any chances with this guy. Then Mr. Cooper dictated his demands. $200,000 in cash, four parachutes, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the plane. Very specific demands. He had definitely planned this out. The pilot relayed the message to air traffic control, setting off a flurry of activity on the ground. Passengers were told the plane could be delayed due to a, quote, minor mechanical issue, unaware of the drama unfolding in the rear. So none of the passengers had any idea what was going on. They thought it was a normal flight. As the plane circled Puget Sound, which is a body of water, an estuary, I believe, that is in Washington, authorities scrambled to meet Cooper's demands. At Seattle-Tacoma Airport, FBI agents gathered the ransom money from several Seattle banks. Four parachutes were secured from a local skydiving school. And it's actually important to note that a single parachuter requires two parachutes. So Mr. Cooper requesting four parachutes doesn't necessarily mean he was anticipating like four people to jump out the plane, but it does mean that he was potentially anticipating bringing a hostage with him. You know, by requesting four parachutes, the FBI had to assume that he was taking a hostage with him, someone else with him as well. Hence, they couldn't give him a faulty parachute for him to just fall to his death because it could have easily risked the life of another hostage or of the hostage. So, you know, they very well could have just been like, oh, here you go, faulty parachute, you'll fall to your death so you won't do any harm to this plane full of people. But because he requested four, they did not know if they were going to harm a, you know, an innocent civilian in the process of giving him a faulty parachute, if that makes sense. So when Flight 305 landed in Seattle, Mr. Cooper allowed the 36 passengers and two of the flight attendants to disembark in exchange for the money and parachutes. The crew remained on board, though, at Cooper's insistence. As night fell, the plane took off again, heading south towards Mexico City with a planned refueling stop in Reno, Nevada. Mr. Cooper's instructions were very precise. Fly at an altitude of 10,000 feet with the landing gear down, wing flaps set at 15 degrees, and the cabin depressurized. He ordered the crew to remain in the cockpit with the door closed. Which, imagine being a crew member trapped in the cockpit with your fellow crew. You know, mind you, the passengers are off the plane, so you don't have to worry about them, but you're worried about yourself. You are worried about yourself because you don't know what Mr. Cooper is doing back there in the cabin with his bomb. We don't know if the bomb is even working. We don't know what he's planning. We don't know anything at this point. So anyway, he had all these demands, all these instructions. Somewhere between Seattle and Reno, Mr. Cooper did the unthinkable. Strapping the money bag to his body, he lowered the rear stairs of the plane and leapt into the stormy, freezing night by himself. The entire remaining crew on board was safe. No one was taken as hostage, even though he requested the four parachutes. He was the only person to disembark the plane, and the plane continued on to Reno, where it landed safely, but D.B. Cooper was nowhere to be found. All that was left behind was a black clip-on tie, a mother-of-pearl tie clip, a hair from Cooper's headrest, and eight filter-tipped Raleigh cigarette butts from the armrest ashtray. Search parties scoured the wilderness below the flight path, but the rugged terrain and poor weather conditions hampered the efforts. And the FBI then underwent an official investigation called NORJAC, Northwest Hijacking, but months turned into years, and they found nothing. No trace of the hijacker was found. The FBI was unable to extract any DNA from their forensic search of the evidence or the aircraft. Even though they had that hair, those cigarette butts, the other materials that, you know, came from him, that they couldn't get any DNA from that. So yeah, that's where we're at this point in the story. But let's take a moment and put ourselves into the shoes of the FBI for a moment. It was chaos. You know, things were handled in a very interesting way, to say the least. You may think that perhaps it was a very high stress situation. And while they could have done more to prevent the hijacking once they landed in Seattle, like they knew that the hijacking was happening, and it didn't seem from like our outsider's perspective that they did a lot, you know, but who can blame them for just trying to make heads or tails of the situation? After all, they were under the impression that he was taking hostages back in the air and potentially jumping out with one as well. While that may be plausible today, they should have been prepared back then because there was a hijacking epidemic on their hands, especially in aviation. I mean, this is before 9/11. But let's talk about hijacking. The term hijacking goes back to Prohibition days when gangsters would rob moonshine trucks, saying, "Hold your hands high, Jack," which is really interesting. I had no idea that that is where the term hijacking came from. Hold your hands high, Jack. However, in the early days of commercial air travel, the idea that someone would hijack a plane was scarcely even considered. When the government started to oversee aviation in 1958, hijacking wasn't technically a crime, and the early design of airport terminals reflected this. Airports were more treated like train stations, where you could walk through the terminal and onto the tarmac and sometimes straight onto the plane itself without showing your ticket or showing anyone your ID or taking off your shoes or anything else for that matter. Then in 1961, that's when the epidemic of hijackings began. So way before 9/11, the first wave of hijackers all wanted passage to Cuba. May 1st, 1961 was the first American hijacking perpetrated by Antulio Ramirez Ortiz, an electrician in Miami. Ramirez got on a Key West-bound flight, held a knife to the pilot's throat, and announced that he had been hired to assassinate Fidel Castro and wanted to go to Havana to warn him. In the second wave, the skyjackers broadened their horizons to more distant lands. There were skyjackers like Rafael Minichiello, an Italian-American Marine who hijacked a plane from Los Angeles to Rome. He was hailed as a hero upon landing, interestingly, and served only 18 months in prison because the Italians refused to extradite him. Minichiello was a good-looking guy and actually ended up with a role in a spaghetti Western film. So that's another skyjacking. Eventually, skyjackers morphed into classic kidnappers who demanded ransom. This trend was started by Arthur Gates Barkley, an unemployed truck driver who had a dispute with the IRS. Barkley hijacked a plane from Phoenix to Washington, D.C., where he demanded $100 million in cash be given to him by the Supreme Court. After that, skyjackers started asking for money and gold bars and crates of liquor and cigarettes and anything their hearts desired in exchange for a safe landing and whatnot. All the while, for some reason, hijacking wasn't considered a serious threat by airlines or passengers. Like, they thought of it as more of an inconvenience than anything else. Like, it wasn't, to them, a severe safety risk? But the passengers kind of all assumed that if the plane was hijacked, they would simply be flown down to Havana, where the hijacker would be taken off the plane. Might have to spend a night in Havana. Maybe they could catch a show or buy some cigars and rum and have a good story to tell. They didn't think they were going to be killed, you know, or anything was going to happen to them. They're like, oh, this is just inconvenient. Someone has to pay up, you know, and we have to be, you know, landed in a different place than where we want to be, sort of thing. Since passengers weren't yet demanding extra security, because like I said, they didn't see it as a serious threat, only really an inconvenience, not a safety threat, the airlines just continued business as usual. They were like, we don't want to change anything because we think that security screenings would alienate customers. And if they treated all their customers like criminals, like suspects, people would opt to drive to their destinations instead of fly. So nowadays, we know security to be kind of annoying, but just, you know, something we do that is important for our safety and for everyone's safety, that, you know, it's important. I think we can all agree we're glad that security exists, like TSA exists. Can it be annoying at times? Sure, but it's for our own good. I think we can kind of all agree with that. So at the time, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even when our story is taking place with DB Cooper, they were like, eh, you know, it's fine. We don't want to alienate anyone. We don't want people to drive instead of fly. So whenever the idea of physically screening all passengers was suggested, the airline lobby would shoot it down and force the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, to come up with the weakest security improvements. After all, hijacking really only cost an airline an average of $20,000 or $30,000, whereas X-ray screenings and security personnel would cost millions. So it was more expensive for them to have proper security in place. They're like, we'd rather just bite the bullet of the 20 or 30,000 when we're hijacked and, you know, just go case by case basis, that sort of thing. Just take them as they come. So for the airlines, the smart financial choice was clear. Put up with the hijackings, comply totally, and keep the customer experience on the ground the same. No TSA. Still, something had to be done. If the airlines were unwilling to consider mandatory screenings and checkpoints in the terminals, some less intrusive solutions had to be considered. So in 1968, the FAA created an anti-hijacking task force to come up with solutions that would be palatable to the airlines. A tactic that was seriously considered by the FAA was to build a phony Havana airport in South Florida. In this plan, the hijackers would believe they're landing in Havana, but when they get off the plane, they'd be arrested by U.S. agents. Alas, the fake airport, it turned out, was too expensive. So that was like one option that they considered for, I don't know. I mean, I can't even like begin to rationalize. I guess it makes sense in some way, shape, or form, but like, where would they put this thing? Like, it just feels like they're skirting around the issue. Like, they just need to, it's like when you know you have to do something that you really don't want to do, but you know you have to do it, but you'd rather take any other avenue to get there because it feels like it'd be easier, but it really just would be better to do the right thing, you know? There were other creative solutions, like a hijacker ejection seat. Yeah, it is what it sounds like, an ejector seat in a plane. There was also one patent for an injector seat, which would have a hypodermic injection apparatus arranged for driving the needle of a hypodermic syringe through the seat cushion and into the passenger to instantly sedate or kill the passenger. So these are other ways that they were trying to deal with the hijacker problem. Ultimately, the FAA realized that there was one place you had to stop on your way to a plane, and that was to get a boarding pass or purchase a ticket. The FAA solution, therefore, was to train the ticket agents in 25 behavioral cues that might indicate trouble. These were things like, quote, not maintaining appropriate eye contact, not caring about your luggage, or wearing military surplus gear. If ticket takers saw any of these behavioral traits in a customer, they would very discreetly ask that they go to a room on the side and be searched. As you can probably imagine, the solution proved to be a failure because imagine like you're just a shy person and you don't want to make eye contact, or you just, maybe you're hungover, maybe you're tired, I don't know, or you're just kind of acting funny because that's just how you are, but you're not a threat. You'd be traumatized in that little room, I'm sure. So we all know the solution they ultimately came up with, screening everyone and their luggage with x-ray machines and requiring ID. This wasn't seriously considered until two hijackings changed everything. The DB Cooper hijacking that we started out with and the Southern Airways hijacking. So I've definitely heard of the DB Cooper hijacking because it's actually mentioned quite a lot in pop culture. I guess pop culture, is that the word for it? Like TV shows and movies and stuff. Like they haven't solved the case. And yet I feel like I've heard of it in various things. Like if you guys have ever seen Prison Break, the TV show, he's mentioned. I don't want to spoil anything, but he's mentioned in the show, like other things. So I've known about DB Cooper, but I've never heard of, prior to researching, the Southern Airways hijacking. And there's actually an excerpt that I'm going to read from 99percentinvisible.org. It's a really interesting story, so buckle up. In November 1972, three fugitives hijacked Southern Airways Flight 49. They wanted $10 million and threatened to crash the plane into the Oak Ridge National Laboratory near Knoxville, Tennessee, if they didn't get their money. Interestingly, about that laboratory near Knoxville that they were going to crash the plane into if they didn't get their $10 million, at the heart of that lab is a uranium-235 reactor. All of a sudden, everyone realized that an airplane could be, if crashed into that location, a weapon of mass destruction. The issue was then Southern Airways just didn't have $10 million at their disposal, but they delivered $2 million to the hijackers when they landed in Tennessee. The hijackers, who had drunk all the liquor on the plane, didn't bother to count the money, and they flew on to Havana, where they were captured by Cuban authorities. Crisis averted. But that hijacking, coupled with DB Cooper's hijacking, was a wake-up call for airlines and the government. And so it's really interesting, like, the fact that they had the smarts to know that if they crashed the plane into the lab, it would explode and be a weapon of mass destruction. Or maybe they didn't. Like, there's a world in which maybe they didn't know that, but I think they knew that. Like, based on what I've read, I think they knew that. So they knew that, but then they just proceeded to get so drunk and excited about it all, the hijackers did, that they were so obliterated, they didn't even think to count the money that they were given. Only 2 million, big difference between 2 and 10 million. And then they were captured by Cuban authorities because they, I guess all these hijackers are just flying to Havana. Not sure why Havana specifically. I definitely could have looked into that more, but that hijacking was a wake-up call. And we all know how security escalated even more post 9/11 with the creation of the Transportation Safety Administration, TSA. So back to DB Cooper, because I'm sure you guys are wondering, okay, how have we not figured out who the guy is? Who is Mr. Cooper? Who is the guy that ordered a bourbon and soda and was smoking a cigarette so casually, had the flight attendant sit down next to him? Like, who is this guy? He left behind evidence.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, who is DB Cooper? Is that even his real name? Could he even still be out there? Among the 800 suspects, 800 guys, 800 suspects determined by the FBI in the years after the incident, there are a couple people who seem to be the most likely culprits. Richard Floyd McCoy Jr. is often discussed as a potential suspect in the infamous DB Cooper hijacking because McCoy's own criminal escapades were strikingly similar to Cooper's. On April 7th, 1972, just a few months after the DB Cooper hijacking, Richard McCoy executed a remarkably similar crime. He boarded United Airlines Flight 855, a Boeing 727, same plane that DB Cooper was on, in Newark, New Jersey, bound for Los Angeles. Like Cooper, McCoy was very prepared. He carried a fake grenade and a pistol and handed a note to the flight attendant stating that he had a bomb. McCoy demanded $500,000 in cash and four parachutes. When the plane landed in San Francisco, McCoy's demands were met and the ransom money, $500,000, and the parachutes were delivered. McCoy then directed the plane to take off again, instructed the pilot to fly towards Provo, Utah, and at a certain point during the flight, McCoy parachuted out of the plane over Utah with the ransom money. So pretty much the same exact crime that DB Cooper had committed. Unlike Cooper, though, McCoy's escape was short-lived. The FBI apprehended him just 2 days later in his home in Provo, Utah. So he had told the pilot, fly towards Provo, Utah. That was where his house was. So not a great thing to do if you're trying to evade capture, first of all. But second of all, his wife, McCoy's wife, had found the ransom money and alerted the authorities, leading to her husband's arrest. So she did him dirty. She turned him in. Evidence against him was mounting, overwhelming. The handwriting on the note matched his, the fingerprints that were found on the plane matched his, and he had extensive knowledge of skydiving. McCoy was convicted of air piracy and received a 45-year prison sentence from all of that. However, on August 10th, 1974, McCoy escaped from the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. Get this, this is how he escaped, by hijacking a garbage truck, only to be killed in a shootout with FBI agents 3 months later. So he was free for 3 months, then he unfortunately was killed in a shootout with FBI agents. McCoy's son, Richard Rick McCoy III, also firmly believes the DB Cooper rumors linking McCoy, his father, and DB Cooper. Like, he thinks that he was also DB Cooper. Rick has even provided DNA evidence to the FBI in hopes of finally resolving the longstanding mystery of DB Cooper's identity. Rick says that it was his mother, Karen McCoy, so the woman who turned in her husband, who stood as his father's accomplice in the crime. So that's one suspect, Mr. McCoy, but let's talk about a more under-the-radar suspect throughout the years, a guy named Sheridan Peterson. And Sheridan Peterson fell under suspicion within a week of the skyjacking, but wasn't interviewed by the FBI until decades later. Peterson, a former Boeing employee, worked in the department that wrote the flight manual for the Boeing 727 jet that was hijacked. A very important detail, a great job to have if you're going to be the kind of person that, you know, hijacks an airplane and then knows that the airplane has back stairs that you can open and jump from. Like, I myself didn't even know that an airplane had back stairs. I guess it makes sense, but I guess there's like a way to escape out the back. I guess I can't really think right now of like the geography of a plane or like the makeup of a plane, but a person that worked on the manual for the exact jet that was hijacked would know the ins and outs, every, you know, nook and cranny of that thing, like D.B. Cooper did. An accomplished skydiver, Mr. Peterson worked for a time as a smoke jumper in Montana. He also worked at the Issaka Skydive Center in the early 60s, the same place that would later provide parachutes used by D.B. Cooper in his escape. So a few things pointing to the fact that he could be D.B. Cooper, knowing the ins and outs of a plane, working at the place that provided the parachutes, and having confidence, you know, jumping, skydiving, you know, that kind of adds up in that way. Unlike descriptions of Cooper, though, which the FBI described as white male, 6'1", 170 to 175 pounds, age mid-40s, olive complexion, brown eyes, black hair, conventional cut parted on the left, Mr. Peterson has blue eyes, not brown. And while Cooper had chain-smoked on the flight, literally, had an ashtray there to prove it with all the butts in there, Peterson is not known to have been a smoker. At the time of the hijacking, Mr. Peterson told authorities he was living with his wife and family in Nepal, although he offered no definitive proof that he hadn't traveled back at the time of the hijacking. So a lot of these things can kind of be explained away, if you think about it. Like, he could have been wearing colored contacts, he could have just been smoking on that day to maybe throw off the scent that, you know, it could be him in real life, because, you know, people would be like, oh, he's not a smoker. You could just take up smoking for a day. You could, if you, you know, wanted to fit the profile of the kind of person that would steal money and jump out of a plane. Sure, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe he's a really good actor. The next possible contender was Robert Wesley Rackstraw. So this is the third person we're going to talk about that could be D.B. Cooper. Mr. Rackstraw captivated the public's imagination with his colorful past and the circumstantial evidence linking him to the crime. Rackstraw was a Vietnam War veteran with a decorated military career, including experience as a paratrooper and helicopter pilot. Why is this important? Well, Rackstraw's training in parachuting and survival tactics paralleled the skills required to execute Cooper's daring jump from the plane. And like I said a few moments ago, the witness description of D.B. Cooper described him as a man in his mid-40s with a particular build and demeanor. And some people believe that Rackstraw fits this description well, especially in photographs from the time. It didn't help that during the investigation, Rackstraw reportedly made ambiguous statements during interviews, neither confirming or denying his involvement in the hijacking. And these statements included suggestive remarks like, could have been me, but I mean, come on. Like, anyone could really say that. I mean, I personally would never be dumb enough to do that. Like, if I'm a part of an investigation, like, how, why would I, like, waste people's time, also, you know, potentially go to jail for something I didn't do just to be funny like that, or just to be elusive and weird? I don't know. But yeah, he said things like, could have been me. Obviously, this man had a level of audacity and cunning that many believed would be required to successfully carry out such a heist. As the cherry on top, in the 70s, Mr. Rackstraw was already in hot water with grand theft, $75,000 worth of bad checks, and the possible murder of his stepfather. These are just a few of the things that authorities had him for at that time. So he was no stranger of running into hot water with the law. After being acquitted of the murder charge, Rackstraw, for some reason, decided to fake his own death in 1978 by logging a false mayday call from a rented plane in Northern California. He spent 2 years in prison for check fraud and theft of an aircraft, all because he wanted to fake his own death and, like, start over, I guess. I'm not sure why. So he was doing crazy things during the time period of D.B. Cooper. Despite the mounting circumstantial evidence and his rocky past, the FBI never officially charged Mr. Rackstraw with the hijacking. However, Rackstraw gained significant media attention in 2016 when a documentary titled D.B. Cooper, Case Closed? Aired, and a book, The Last Master Outlaw, was published, focusing on him as a prime suspect. The documentary presented new evidence, including an analysis of letters sent by Cooper to newspapers suggesting they contained hidden codes pointing to Rackstraw. But although Rackstraw's military background in these letters made him a plausible suspect, there was no direct evidence linking him to the hijacking. So the FBI conducted multiple interviews and investigations, but ultimately found insufficient evidence to pursue charges against him. He definitely enjoyed the notoriety that these allegations brought him, but it seems that that's all Mr. Rackstraw really wanted in the end: attention. He consistently denied being D.B. Cooper, maintaining his innocence until his death in 2019. but the theory that Robert Rackstraw was D.B. Cooper remains one of the most compelling in the pantheon of potential suspects. So that's another suspect. I think we're up to three at this point. Next up is Kenneth Christensen. Kenneth had a more direct link to the Cooper incident than Rackstraw. Christensen served as a paratrooper in World War II, giving him the experience necessary to execute a high-altitude jump from a plane, similar to what D.B. Cooper did, but more importantly, he worked as a flight attendant, and then as a mechanic for the Northwest Orient Airlines, the same airline involved in the hijacking. His knowledge of the aircraft, specifically the Boeing 727, which D.B. Cooper chose for the hijacking, would have given him insight into its features, like the stairway in the back used for his escape. Witness descriptions of D.B. Cooper, back to that again, were pretty vague, you know, but some people who knew Christensen believed he matched the general description of Cooper provided by those people that were on the plane, and this included his age, height, and build. Then, after the hijacking, Christensen also reportedly bought a house with cash, which seemed unusual and slightly suspicious given his modest salary. You know, because remember, D.B. Cooper requested money. Like, where did the money go? What did he spend it on? You know, would he spend it on a house? Maybe. While not definitive proof, it definitely raised questions about where the money came from, like Christensen buying this house out of the blue. Even more suspicious is that Christensen's brother Lyle claimed that Kenneth made a deathbed confession saying, quote, "There's something you should know, but I can't tell you." And another thing, after Christensen's death, his family found a folder of Northwest Orient Airlines news clippings, including articles about the D.B. Cooper hijacking. This unusual interest in the case further fueled speculation. Like, all these things are kind of adding up to point to him. Perhaps the most damning evidence of all is that there's no definitive record of Christensen's whereabouts on the day of the hijacking. He has no alibi, allowing for the possibility that he could have been in Portland to board Flight 305. Despite these intriguing connections, there's no direct evidence, once again, linking Mr. Christensen to the crime. Fingerprints and DNA samples, remember the hair that was on the seat and then the fingerprints on the cigarettes, the evidence that they have from the hijacking doesn't match him, does not match Christensen. So the evidence that we have is all circumstantial. Plus, while the physical appearance may show uncanny resemblance, the personalities just don't match up. People who knew Christensen described him as a mild-mannered person, not fitting of the daring and bold profile of D.B. Cooper, someone that could, you know, do all the things that he did. Mr. Christensen doesn't seem like a likely candidate, person that would do all that. So the case for Kenneth Christensen as D.B. Cooper is built on intriguing coincidences and circumstantial evidence, as far as we know. His military background, employment with Northwest Orient, physical resemblance, and unexplained wealth, buying a house out of the blue, all suggest that he could have been the mysterious hijacker. However, the absence of direct evidence, that DNA evidence, and the FBI's reluctance to officially identify him as the prime suspect leave the case unsolved. And so, the case of D.B. Cooper was officially closed by the FBI in 2016, which is interesting that they would, there's so many open cases these days, like from years and years and years ago. So it's interesting that they decided to close the case in 2016. They have DNA evidence. Like, it'd be different if they didn't have DNA evidence. So interesting. But of course, you know, them closing the case in 2016 hasn't stopped new suspects and evidence from emerging as recent as this year, guys. Pride investigator Eric Ulis thinks that he's cracked the case wide open 53 years later. Yes, this is breaking news. And it all hinges on D.B. Cooper's clip-on tie that he left on the plane. Yes, the clip-on tie, one of the few pieces of concrete evidence in the whole case. Investigators at the time were unable to find DNA on the tie, but they did, however, find microscopic pieces of metal. Ulis says that new tests have found one of those metal fragments could have only come from a metals factory that was located in Pittsburgh at the time. Ulis says that said metals factory made parts for Boeing planes. It's long been believed that D.B. Cooper had ties to the airline industry due to his use of aviation jargon during the hijacking. Ulis says that the new evidence points to a man named Vince Peterson, a titanium research engineer who worked at a metals factory in Pittsburgh. Vince would have been 52 at the time of the skyjacking, around the right age, and his height makes him an anomaly for the time. Ulis says it doesn't obviously prove Vince Peterson was D.B. Cooper, but it certainly is intriguing. So, could be another potential suspect. And while it's interesting and kind of exciting to try to crack the code and the mystery, you know, figure out who did it, odds are whoever he is didn't in fact survive the fall. I mean, think about it. Though it was initially believed that D.B. Cooper was a battle-scarred skydiver, perhaps a paratrooper, further analysis found that he was likely no expert. No experienced parachutist would have jumped in the pitch-black night in the rain with a 200-mile-an-hour wind in his face, wearing loafers and a trench coat, said FBI Special Agent Larry Carr in 2007. Investigators also thought that Cooper acted alone. If he had worked with an accomplice, he would have requested a much more specific flight path rather than saying fly to Mexico and jumping out when visibility was poor. Furthermore, this is actually the most interesting part of the story, I think. None of the money, the ransom money that he requested, that he was given by the government, has ever re-entered circulation. So the serial numbers, they took note of that or something like that to make sure that if the money came into circulation, they could track it. I mean, who knows if something dirty happened, laundering-wise, whatever, to clean the money. But to our knowledge, the FBI's knowledge, the money has never re-entered circulation. And why would a person ask for money just to sit on it and never spend it? This kind of all points to his demise and it all sinking to the bottom of the ocean. Plus, in 1980, a child's discovery reaffirmed this theory as well. 8-year-old Brian Ingram was digging in the sand on the banks of Washington's Columbia River when he found a bundle of rotting $20 bills totaling $5,800. When his parents contacted the police, they learned that the serial numbers on the cash matched those from the stash given to D.B. Cooper. Aside from a few items left on the plane, this is the only material evidence found from the hijacking. And funny enough, so the kid that discovered the money, Ingram, 6 years after he discovered it, he was allowed to keep $2,700, or specifically $2,760 of it. In 2008, he sold 15 of the fragmented $20 bills at auction for $37,000. Yeah. And an interesting fact, an interesting plain fact, in the wake of the hijacking, the Federal Aviation Administration ordered that something called a Cooper vane, or Cooper vanes, named after D.B. Cooper himself, must be installed in all Boeing 727 aircrafts. And a Cooper vane is a small latch fitted to the outside of all planes with rear stairs. So I guess not every plane has rear stairs, maybe just the Boeing 727 and similar aircraft. So they require now that there's this small latch fitted on the outside of all the planes with rear stairs, and it prevents anyone from opening the door mid-flight from the inside like D.B. Cooper did as he leapt into the air and vanished into obscurity. So next time you're on a plane, be on the lookout for the Cooper vane, as a testament to one of the biggest unsolved mysteries in aviation today, D.B. Cooper. Who was he? Will we ever know? Will we ever know? There is tangible evidence to support the fact that this happened, although to a lot of people, it probably feels like a fever dream. Like, how does someone just vanish without a trace? No one, you know, in his life comes to speak or, you know, say that he's missing. Some guy somewhere is missing. I mean, I guess there's so many missing people in a day. But it's just interesting that nothing, no puzzle pieces came together to identify who this guy was, even though there's DNA evidence. So very, very intriguing story, D.B. Cooper. If you didn't know the full story, now you do. And a lot of other things along the way, because we went through a lot of the suspects and similar crimes and things like that. So I hope you guys enjoyed this story as much as we enjoyed researching and looking into it. Shout out to Sarah for the great research once again. Couldn't have done it without her, but a lot of the pieces were put together for me, at least. I know we didn't figure out who D.B. Cooper was, but now I kind of understand why he's never been identified, because he maybe died, you know, he maybe did not survive. But it's interesting and kind of fun to think that he maybe did. I mean, granted, he committed a crime, let's be real, like he's not a hero by any means, but it's just interesting, you know. Oh, Wow, guys. Wow, wow, wow. Okay, thank you for listening to this episode of Found Objects Podcast. As always, give us a follow on Instagram, Found Objects Podcast. I'll put all the photos of everything I was talking about today on Instagram over there. And give us a nice 5-star review if you're feeling nice. Follow us so you never miss an episode. Every Wednesday in the morning I upload. And remember, don't you dare forget, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.